Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Kristen Turner, and this is New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. Today, I'm talking to Lauren J. Carer about their book, Queer Voices in Hip Hop, Cultures, Communities, and Contemporary Performance, published in 2022 by University of Michigan Press. Carer presents an alternative and more inclusive narrative about the development of hip hop that includes the contributions of queer people throughout the history of the genre. They consider the role of disco, house music, and the ballroom scene in New York to demonstrate how these different communities and networks played and continue to play a role in hip-hop. Carer also explores bounce, a regional form of hip-hop with deep roots in New Orleans and its queer communities that has recently broken out into the national circulation. Queer Voices in Hip-Hop, Cultures, Communities, and Contemporary Performance also recuperates and challenges the ideas that hip-hop is an entirely misogynist and homophobic genre. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm excited to talk to you about your new book.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm excited as well.
So how did you come to this topic?
So years ago, I won't say how many, when I was thinking about going into a more academic-oriented path from a performance path, I started doing field work at the now defunct Michigan Women's Music Festival. I was very interested in what we call women's music and how it developed in the last few years and what the place was of, you know, queer folks or non-cisgender folks in that sort of developing community. And one of the things that really struck me when I was there, and this is like in the early 2000s, is that by that point, there were already dedicated day stages at this festival dedicated just to rap and hip hop performers. So the first time I encountered this, I was really surprised because, you know, one of the narratives that had already always been told to me is, you know, hip hop is misogynistic, it's homophobic, it's not, you know, it's not a safe sort of genre for queer folks. And of course, that's, you know, as I realize, really not only not true, but that there are whole sort of pockets of queer communities and queer hip hop communities. So when I finished that project, I kind of returned to this idea of hip hop because it's really become such a prevalent genre, sound, it's influenced, you know, most pop music that we hear on the radio in the US. It's become global. And we really have not had a lot of conversations about the role of queer communities as listeners and as performers in that genre. And so that's what I sort of set out to explore is, you know, how are these things connected? How are queer performers expressing themselves in distinctly queer types of ways? And how do things like race and gender intersect with all of these issues?
So let's start right at where sort of you ended in that answer. Rap does have this reputation for misogyny and homophobia. What did you find that challenges that and undermines that reputation?
Well, I think that this has been a conversation among scholars and hip-hop practitioners and fans since the genre's beginnings. And I don't want to say that there's never instances of homophobia or misogyny in the genre, right? Certainly, there's plenty of mainstream examples we could point to. But I think when we overemphasize that, it does a couple of things. One is it sort of erases queer practitioners, queer fans, erases them from the conversation, right? We're basically saying queer people are not here. And that's simply not true. So part of my project was to sort of recover that and assert queerness, really not just at the margins, but central in both a contemporary and historical perspective, right? The other thing that we do when we insist on hip hop's misogyny and homophobia is because hip hop is one of the few genres that continues to be strongly associated with Black performers and Black fans, is we're sort of overemphasizing and pathologizing homophobia and misogyny within those communities. So this was something I also wanted to be really cognizant of, is we often frame hip hop as a Black music genre as inherently more homophobic and more harmful than other genres. And what are the implications of that, right? So I wanted to kind of recover this idea that there are Black queer practitioners. There's, you know, building on, for example, Joan Morgan's notion of hip hop feminism and how that has expanded in the last 20 years or so, thinking about how we can extend that to queerness as well, right? There are places within hip hop for everyone, but there's also active resistance against those narratives within hip hop as well.
So I sort of saw, as I was reading your book, you know, there were some chapters that really dug down into particular communities, particular types of music. But then overarching that was this kind of larger narrative where, at least that I was reading, where you were showing how those genres and hip hop itself has roots in the history of queer communities and the acceptance of queerness and queer sort of, you know, gender nonconforming presentations and that sort of stuff in working class and Black communities in the earlier 20th century in music and sort of in kind of social culture in general. So maybe we can kind of tease those out a little bit. And I'd love to start with first that more historical look at the resonances and connections between those early 20th century communities and sort of acceptance of gender and sexuality, nonconforming, I guess, is one way to talk about it in queer communities in early 20th century. And then what you see those resonances are with hip hop.
Yeah. So interestingly, in this project, I kind of worked backwards. So I'm primarily interested in more contemporary artists and music. But one of the things I was finding is especially for artists who exist in, who are working within cities and geographical regions that have strong connections to ballroom culture, right, which is a kind of focal point for Black and Latinx queer communities that originated in New York City, especially in the 1970s, but grew in the 80s, 90s, and through today. I was finding that some of those artists, because they're also connected to those communities, were engaging with different aspects of that culture in their hip hop music. And they were doing that in a way that really clearly articulated a Black queer identity within rap, right? And so, you know, that led me to go, okay, well, like, where does this start, right? Can we go backwards? And what I was kind of thinking about was, at the same time, because we have these prevalent narratives about hip hop's homophobia, I was wondering, where did that start, right? Like, was that at the beginning? Did it happen somewhere along the way? And it's kind of hard to pinpoint, because one of the challenges of doing a historical project focused on queer identities is a lot of times the experiences of those communities are not, they're not well documented, or they're, especially in the case of Black queer communities, not, like, our language for these things change, right? And so sometimes it's hard to know exactly what you're looking for unless you have a particular connection, you can talk to people face to face. So, you know, I was kind of working backwards and thinking about, okay, well, what's happening as hip hop's originating, right? In the 1970s, you have this sort of post-Stonewall moment where queer folks are experiencing increasingly pushing back against, you know, oppression, against a legal system, pushing back against sort of social expectations of heterosexuality. And of course, music is a very important part of how these communities are coming together. So the emergence of disco initially is really significant for creating spaces in which queer folks, and especially queer folks of color, can just sort of exist in a somewhat public space, right? And so there's, you know, musical elements, but I especially thinking about disco as Nadine Hubbs talks about this, as more of a social space in addition to a musical space. I'm also thinking about its proximity to other, you know, music cultures that are happening at the time. So the earliest iterations of hip hop were, you know, DJs innovating with disco records, other records as well, right? It was quite diverse, but disco was really at the foundations of how hip hop developed, both in terms of DJing techniques and also its sound, right? And so for thinking about those relationships, to me, it was important to center that these musical relationships also connect to queer communities and the overlap between the audiences for these genres and the folks who are participating in the social spaces that are connected to these music genres, right? I'm also thinking about the role of house music, which sort of develops after there's this backlash against disco and dance musics and queer dance cultures get pushed sort of back underground. They don't ever go away, but they do sort of disappear from the mainstream in some ways. But they continue to be really important in terms of club spaces, which again, historically are very important for queer communities. And so I'm thinking about how there's musical developments that are contemporaneous to both hip hop development and house music development. And so we have evidence of certain DJs who are gaining inspiration, you know, hip hop DJs going to queer clubs and feeling deeply uncomfortable in those queer spaces, but also paying attention to what musical developments are happening there and taking that inspiration. So you have this sort of cross-pollination going on. But in these sort of narratives that we tell about that development, the queer center of those musical developments has been largely erased from that conversation. And so my goal, especially with that more historical chapter in the book, is to recontextualize these things as actually more closely related than how we've been talking about it. And trying to trace this moment where, you know, burgeoning hip hop artists are trying to redefine themselves as something distinct from disco, which, you know, is important when you're innovating and developing something new to make your own mark. But the way that that turns out sometimes is a distancing from these other cultures that are closely connected to queer communities. And so I don't think that hip hop is inherently homophobic, but I do think there are some hip hop practitioners who have intentionally distanced themselves from queerness. And that has become sort of the narrative that we tell about hip hop until very, very recently.
So you mentioned in your last answer sort of different pockets or different kinds of genres and communities that were important to that development that you were trying to bring into this narrative of hip hop. So there's house, there's disco, and there's ballroom. Maybe we could start with house. Can you talk about that a little more?
So house music is a genre of electronic dance music that developed a post-disco that really emphasizes four on the floor dance beats, electronic looping, remixing. There are some lyrical elements, but the lyrics are not really emphasized in this genre. They might be used as sort of ornamentation or additional rhythmic motivic material. And the emphasis, of course, is on dancing, right? It's dance music intentionally. So this is a genre that originated, most people pinpoint it to The Warehouse, which is a club in Chicago that at the time, DJ Frankie Knuckles was an important figure working there. And it had a pretty, I would say, diverse clientele, but there was a very large Black queer population that found a home in this particular club. And of course, this style also spread through dance networks and queer networks to New York City. in New York City is where ballroom culture originated. So sort of the story that's told about ballroom is that in the 1960s, 70s, in the sort of underground LGBTQ cultures, you have Black queer drag queens who are being excluded from the drag balls that are being put on by predominantly white gay and lesbian organizations. And so you have these sort of separate groups that originate out of necessity, out of that place of exclusion, that starts to develop into its own subculture. And so ballroom is not really, although now we have sort of musical styles that are developed within it and part of it, ballroom was sort of drawing on the sounds of house music and other popular music and things that really resonated with a particular queer and trans community that was gathering in these spaces, right? And so with ballroom, you have these sort of competitions where people compete for, there's gesture-based ones, dance-based categories, there's a more visual presentation style. There's a lot of considerations about gender, what your gender is, how you're presenting your gender, how that fits into sort of the broader culture's binary view of male and female, masculine, feminine. There's a lot more play between those different categories and different ballroom presentations. And so because a lot of these are very gesture-based competitions, there's a soundtrack that's very important to it. And so as the category is sort of evolved and codified, the soundtrack has also kind of codified in many ways because you want certain tempos or certain sounds to reflect the gestures that are expected, you know, in the moment of competition. And so to take it back to hip hop, if I can, there are ways in which a number of queer artists, not all queer artists, but a number of queer artists who have connections to this subculture, use some of these sounds and other aesthetics, visuals, especially if we're talking about music videos, for example, but also sonic references too. They might include a sample that's often used either in house music or in ballroom competitions or both, right? Or even just the style, right? Like I think the rapper Azalea Banks is really well known for incorporating the style of house music and ballroom house music into her own hip hop, just as she sort of lyrically references that subculture as well.
What about disco?
Yeah, so disco... Again, I mean, if you want to talk about how it originated, it was more of a space and a sort of social context. As the music sort of starts to standardize, there's sort of a shared tempo that emerges. And this is important because, again, the impetus is for dancing, right? So you want to keep people moving on the floor as seamlessly as possible. And so you start to see a sort of a standardized tempo so that it's easier for DJs to move from one track to the other. So there's no interruption for the dancers. And that's a technique that, of course, carries over into house music as well. The thing with disco is that at one point in the 70s, it becomes so mainstream that it loses a lot of that, a lot of the sort of queer sociality that was attached to it very early on. By the time you get films like Saturday Night Live, you know, the visual images of what we think of disco has become very white, very heterosexualized. And then, of course, the backlash against it comes from this very white male sort of anxieties about, is the sort of soundtrack of our culture something that privileges Black listening practices, queer folks, women, Black women in particular, if we think about who the main stars of disco were at that time. And so there's a lot of sort of intersections between race and gender and sexuality and the anxieties around that at the time that really influence how the genre develops and then sort of how it gets sort of pushed back into this underground space by the end of the 1970s.
One of the things that's really striking me both about your book and now your answers is that a lot of times when there's a history of a commercial form of music like hip hop, it's really centered around different producers and different record companies and, you know, this sort of very capitalist sort of way of looking at things, a business-oriented way. But you are really privileging particular scenes, particular clubs, particular places where music is being made. And you know, is that a function of the fact that that is where queer people can find comfort and find community? Or is there another reason that that is a more important place to tell this history than in sort of this more capitalistic, you know, record executive, record company kind of history?
Well, I think it's a combination of factors. I think on one level, it's because when I started this project, we didn't really have any mainstream openly queer artists like we do now. And so it was partly out of necessity to look at more localized scenes, right? When I started working on New Orleans Bounce, it was sort of before mainstream national artists started picking up on aspects of that and incorporating that into what we might hear on the radio now, right? It was pre-Beyonce formation, pre-Drake engaging with that style. So it was partly out of necessity for that reason. But I do think that historically, there's a way in which pockets of queer communities form and chosen families are formed and kinship networks are formed. And the way that that connects to musical expressions is also something that I'm very interested in and tease out in a couple of different chapters within the book. I think at the same time, if we think about the history of hip hop and how it continues, hip hop is also very much about place and space and that context of where an artist is from, what their sort of, you know, what their city is, what their neighborhood is, what their region is. That continues to be very important in the genre, even when we're talking about mainstream artists. So I think, again, just the overlap of what is significant when we're talking about queer histories and queer communities, and how do those overlap with rap history? The importance of geographical place is one of those places of overlap, I think.
Well, you just mentioned Bounce, and that was a great segue for us to talk about Bounce a little more. Can you just define Bounce and talk about that scene in New Orleans?
Sure. So Bounce music is a dance-centric style of hip-hop that is local to New Orleans. It started in the late 1980s when local artists started to do tracks that sampled heavily a tune by the New York City-based Showboys called Drag Rap. A drag referring to the television show of the 1960s, Dragnet, not the act of, you know, dressing and performing in drag. And so that track and some of the samples from it really became the backbone of how Bounce initially developed and continues to be significant today. But it was something that was super local for a really long time. It was local partly because of the sound was just really distinctive to that space. There was a lot of influence from other sort of rhythmic approaches of music traditions in that city, like the brass bands, for example. But the lyrics were, again, thinking about the role of place, super specifically local, like referencing particular housing projects, particular neighborhoods in New Orleans. In the sort of 1990s, when you start to get some artists from New Orleans who are making sort of national inroads, like Lil Wayne, for example, because these artists had sort of national ambitions, a lot of them focused less as their career developed on that sort of distinctive bounce sound, which really appealed very locally, to engaging with a more sort of nationalized sound so that they could reach a broader audience. And so there was sort of a lull, especially in the early 2000s, where bounce was still happening, but it had kind of, you know, reached sort of a, again, like a lull, right? And then right around the time, especially right after Hurricane Katrina hit, and there was this recovery period where a lot of things were shut down, a lot of people were displaced, people had lost a lot. There was a lot of loss, right? This is a moment where bounce really stepped in and became an important part of the soundtrack of folks returning to the city, trying to rebuild, and folks who were not able to return to the city, finding something, a sound that gave them a sense of home, right? So the tempos sped up during this time, and you have a number of queer artists who really emerged as sort of key figures in this genre. I think Big Frida has become pretty well-known outside of New Orleans at this point, due to extensive touring, features on mainstream artist tracks like Beyonce and Drake. She did a collaboration with Kesha right before the pandemic hit. So she's been sort of out there, but there's been other artists who either remained local, like Sissy Nopi, or other folks who are also trying to build national careers on it. One of the things I talk about in the book is that some of what we hear now on the radio has a lot of that bounce influence on it. And a lot of that influence is coming specifically from the queer artists who really became such key figures in that post-Katrina moment. And whether or not they are being adequately recognized for their contributions, right? I don't just mean like legally, although there are some cases like with Beyonce and the late bounce artist Messy Maya, who is sampled on the Formation track. Sometimes folks like that are not getting credit, songwriting credit, or things like that, compensation. What we see more often, I think, is that artists do get recognized, but they're also not put at the forefront in terms of, you know, I'm thinking about summer of 2022, Beyonce's single Break My Soul, which is really more of an interpolation in some ways of a Big Frida song, Explode. What's interesting to me about that collaboration is that there was, you know, songwriting credit, there was compensation, there was a whole, you know, everyone had permission, it was fine. But the way that it's framed, Big Frida is not listed as a featured artist, for example, right? Because it's a sample. It's not something that Big Frida recorded specifically for that track. So because it's a sample, she was given songwriting credit, but wasn't listed as a featured artist, even though her voice is so prominent on that track, right? And so for me, I'm just thinking about, is this something that is appropriative of queer artists? Are we engaging with styles that queer artists have really pioneered without really acknowledging the queer roots of those styles and those innovations? And so that's something that I'm particularly concerned with, especially in this book.
So bounce is, I think, and to my understanding, unusual in these subgenres of hip hop as being very inclusive of queer people and you know, people like Big Frida and so forth, trans people, etc. But that would seem to collide or at least complicate the way that hip hop thinks about authenticity, where authenticity is such an important value of hip hop, but it's an authenticity, as you point out, that has pretty strict parameters about what it means to be authentic. And one would think someone like Big Frida, for instance, doesn't really fit that mold of authenticity. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of complication or really challenge that happens in hip hop when we talk about authenticity?
So I think when we often have a sort of mental idea of what we think a rapper looks or sounds like, it's often a, you know, heterosexual, cisgender, Black male who's also very masculine. And those are the images that have largely been sort of championed by the media. But I think that what that misses is the really diverse types of identities that exist within hip hop, especially if we go outside of the mainstream. I think in the last 30 years, we've already seen how women rappers have to navigate those sort of expectations of authenticity and sort of engaging different strategies to do that. I think for queer artists, the questions about authenticity, if they're there, are quite different. They look and sound different. Clearly, queer artists have to navigate industry expectations, and they do have to sort of negotiate what it means to be working with a genre that's so highly attached to this sort of stereotype of the typical artist. But I don't think that authenticity is really the main concern here, because if you're a queer and a trans person, you're living as an openly queer trans person, that's another type of authenticity, right? That's a claim to authenticity. I don't think that's really the question. I think that the question might be, how do we expand our understanding of hip hop so that those identities are no longer marginalized, aren't seen as sort of outside what's at the core of the genre? And I think that's what I tried to do in this book, is situate them within the center, right? And think about, if hip hop originated from these genres that were already so closely tied to queer communities, then shouldn't we be thinking about contemporary hip hop as also closely tied to these communities?
You mentioned that sort of stereotypical Black, you know, cisgender, straight male rapper. That's like, that's the stereotype of hip hop. And you really challenge that in that kind of answer right there, and that idea in your book. But you also talk about how that, I would say, very traditional concept of what Black masculinity means. Like, how do queer men deal with the pressure of conforming to that stereotype?
Well, I think the artists that I look like just refuse to conform to that stereotype. So I think there are more, the struggle there is more to get an industry and an audience that's primed to only see hip hop artists as, you know, as A, to think about, okay, well, B through Z, right? It also fits in that. I think the struggle is not so much how they express themselves musically. It's how are other people around it engaging with that? So, I mean, I think that's also an important point to think about, is rather than putting the onus of these expectations on individual artists, thinking about all of the sort of context around them, right? I think in New Orleans is a really interesting example, because, you know, most of the folks that I've talked to or seen interviews with in New Orleans is a very open type of place. And the city has a long history of being a sort of haven for folks who don't fit in other places, right? Not just queer and trans folks, but a lot of different people come to New Orleans because they're looking for a place where they can be themselves and exist sort of outside of normal expectations, right? And I think that's absolutely inherent in hip hop. I think, you know, New York City is another example where, you know, there are pockets of these really vibrant queer and trans communities, and I don't think that that's necessarily outside of whatever our norms are anymore in some ways.
I think one of the themes of the book that I saw was you trying to show, or not trying, but succeeding in showing that there are these other types of identities which challenge the stereotype, and that these people who are queer, are trans, and so forth, they have a place in rap, always have to some extent, to one extent or another, in different places, but they still have to, you know, they live in the United States and they are working within an industry where there is a lot of mainstream pressure to conform to a very narrow type of presentation. And so you have Black queer men who have a particular type of Black masculinity that they're being measured against, that, you know, they don't want to, you know, that doesn't fit them, and they don't want to fit that. You also have, you talk about butch women, and sort of female masculinity, which is another type of gender presentation that doesn't fit within that stereotype. What, maybe we can think of it in a bigger sense, because I think you are really sort of zooming out and talking about in your answers about the ways in which we can't forget these queer communities exist, and they're vibrant and they're there, and just and that only looking at sort of very mainstream hip hop misses the point, it seems like. Is that sort of what you're trying to talk about?
So I think for me, when I say that these artists are challenging our sort of expectations, I think I want to say that in a way that doesn't put the onus on individual artists to do that, but it does put the onus on the industry and on audiences, on fans to sort of reorient ourselves, right? Reorient ourselves so that we can understand that these artists are just as central as those that might be more stereotypically, you know, fit the sort of mold of expectation, I guess. I do think, though, that there are sort of subtle ways that we continue to compare different artists to that sort of expectation. So as you mentioned in the book, I talk about a couple examples of butch queer Black women whose gender presentation actually is very much aligned with what our sort of stereotypical idea is, except for the fact that they're queer and they're women, right? So there's a way also in which those artists have not been talked about in the media as sort of important figures for breaking down barriers for queer artists in the genre in the way that queer men have, right? When Lil Nas X comes out as queer, he is hailed as the sort of quote unquote messiah of hip hop, right? That he's going to make hip hop this new queer inclusive space, right? I think Lil Nas X is super important and it's super exciting that he came out and we can see how like queerness in his work, especially since that moment. And that's really important. And I love that we have that in the mainstream now, but I don't want us to forget that he comes from this longer lineage and this longer sort of context of artists, Black queer artists in hip hop and in other genres. And so he's not really an anomaly. It's an anomalous how popular and commercially successful he's been, perhaps. But I don't want to situate him as something that's brand new, that's never happened before, because that's sort of missing the point, I think.
And actually, that reminds me of another concept that you talk about. And Lil Nas, perhaps as an example of this, is this hyper visibility/invisibility thing. And maybe you could weave that into that concept into your conversation.
Sure. So I think one of the sort of dangers in talking about queer artists as queer artists is to like overemphasize their queerness and lose track of all the other things that they are. And I don't want to fall into a trap of essentializing these artists as, you know, quote unquote, queer rappers. But at the same time, if we don't talk about them as queer artists and we don't talk about the specifically queer resonances in their work, we're losing, you know, a big part of the richness of what they're doing, right? And we're missing some really important elements there that have long been invisible, right? Invisible or under discussed, right? And so I think that is sort of the tricky paradox that we have to engage with, is how do we make sure that we're talking about queerness and hip hop and queer artists and highlighting that, but not, you know, overemphasizing queerness as the key point of interest and not collapsing all of these artists who have very diverse styles, very different approaches and musical styles, and collapsing them into, you know, one category simply because of their sexuality. I think especially when I use this paradox to talk about Black queer masculine presenting women, this is also something that that can be problematic for them, because if they don't talk about themselves as queer artists, they run the risk of people presuming that they're heterosexual, because that's still considered the default in our cultures, right? But if they do talk about it, then they open themselves up to targeted harassment beyond just being women, right? They open themselves up to homophobic comments from their peers or from fans, right? And so this is really tricky. How do we navigate this? How do artists navigate this? How do we navigate it as fans? My hope is that as we continue to have these conversations, we'll be able to talk about queerness of these artists and in their work without having to highlight it in a way that detracts from the other aspects of what they're doing, that it will be I hesitate to use the word normalized, but it'll be something that's so widely acknowledged that we won't have to draw so much attention to it. I just don't think that we're at that point yet.
Well, I guess that for me, perhaps one way to think about it is we don't talk about how people are straight unless there's a reason to talk about their relationships or there's something in their music that draws upon how they relate to the world through their sexuality. And if we could get to that point with queer people or through their gender presentation or whatever, that is a way of normalizing it, but it's a way of presenting the conversation or that part of the conversation because it comes up because they've decided it's important, not because outside pressures require that to be important, I guess.
Right, exactly.
And as I think about this kind of larger picture that we're talking about now and the kind of paradox that you find yourself in as a researcher, but that I would also imagine that the artists themselves find themselves caught up in it as well. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the ways that mainstream hip hop, in terms of like big hits and big artists like Beyonce and Drake, you mentioned that they've started to kind of mention or collaborate or maybe even appropriate from particularly bounce in their music. And I'd love for you to sort of dig down into what happened with Formation and Beyonce, because I think it is one of the times when people who were not necessarily fans of rap, who were not necessarily even fans of Beyonce, become aware of bounce because of her doing Formation at the Super Bowl. And, you know, there's ways in which that had this huge mainstream circulation outside of even the circulation of particular genres and maybe even outside of Beyonce's normal circulation because of the Super Bowl. So can you talk a little bit about that example?
Yeah, sure. So Formation, which I love, by the way.
Yeah, I do too, actually. I love that song.
Who doesn't? It's an amazing track. And it was sort of a surprise release in advance of her second visual album, Lemonade. And she released it and then a few days later performed it on the halftime show at the Super Bowl in a very in a sort of aesthetic that was both reminiscent of Michael Jackson's performance, but also had a lot of allusions to like Black Panther aesthetics and things like that. And so a lot of people, when the song came out, read it as one of her most overtly politicized songs to date up to that point, right? The song came out at the same time as the video, and again was part of this visual album project. So I think it's useful for us to think about both the sonic and the visual elements that go into this work, right? The work in its entirety. And so sonically, it samples some vocals from two New Orleans bounce artists. The first is Big Frida, and the second is an artist named Messy Maya, who is now deceased, but was well known as a sort of comedian who had some YouTube videos that were very popular, both gender nonconforming Black queer performers, right? So in the case of Big Frida, there were songwriting credits. She was properly credited, acknowledged as appearing on the track. Big Frida, I think, performed in the song with Beyonce at the New Orleans stop of the Formation tour. So there was some live incorporation of performance with her built into that. Messy Maya's contributions weren't acknowledged initially, though. There was no, and if you're not familiar with either of those artists, it's possible that they sound like the same person because they both have a very similar, accents, very particular New Orleans type of accent and delivery style. And so I think a lot of folks who didn't know much about New Orleans assumed that these were both samples from Big Frida, right? And so Messy Maya's estate actually sued Beyonce for songwriting credit for Maya. And that lawsuit was settled out of court, I believe. But I think the impact of that we see on her latest album, on Renaissance, because she samples so many artists, but part of the sort of promotion around that album was, look how many songwriters are on this album, right? Everyone from like Grace Jones, again, Big Frida, Robin S., you know, all of these folks. So I think that, and then there was also, you know, a way in which we can talk about the visuals of Formation also engaging in similar sort of problematics, which is it used footage from a documentary short about New Orleans Bounce called That Beat. And legally, Beyoncé's team had cleared the use of that material with the owners of the footage. But there were folks who appeared in the documentary, and specifically a young black gay dancer, who, of course, gave their permission to be in the documentary, but had no idea that these images of him were going to be used in this music video. And, you know, the folks that were involved in this conversation were like we love Beyoncé. We want to be part of this. We just wish that someone had reached out to us and asked. We just wish that someone had said, hey, can we use this footage and credit you, right? And so there's that sort of engagement where we see influence of queer cultures and Black queer culture specifically, but the concern is when you take it out of that context for audiences who don't know, they don't know. They don't know the historical roots of that. And the fact that a lot of these art forms are coming out of sort of necessary mechanisms for survival, right? Finding ways to make culture to thrive in an environment that may be hostile to you, which is not always the case, but for a lot of queer and trans folks, that is the case. I think that's a pretty big erasure. And I think that's something to be concerned about. And so, you know, most people are very excited to see Beyoncé acknowledging, as she does a better job of on Renaissance, acknowledging a lot of the Black queer influences in her work. How does that acknowledgement translate into something for the communities who produced it?
Well, it seems to me one of the things that you're pointing out is the difference between following the legal requirements for acknowledging people's work, giving them a songwriting credit, you know, all of those things, and what the larger issue of representation and of permission for people who maybe that's not a legal requirement, but it seems to be an ethical requirement. And one perhaps that Beyoncé and other artists did not think about because they are in the mainstream. They do fit, they don't have that particular challenge to deal with, though, of course, all, you know, Beyoncé has her own sets of challenges, but maybe not that particular one that maybe someone like Big Frida is, and that, you know, that queer community around Bounce is experiencing, and so is not as careful with that music and with those images, and as she could have been, because she did do the legal thing. She just didn't you are arguing that she did not necessarily do the ethical thing, and as happens with other artists as well.
Right. And I think that, you know, there's a history of discourse about the ethics of sampling practices in hip hop, and that's largely been about intellectual property and how things get used or reused, to the point where now we have a legal system that has kind of forced some producers to change their approach to sampling or abandon sampling, right? I think that with an artist like Beyoncé, and I think we see this a lot on Renaissance, because she has the resources, she can continue to engage in those types of sampling practices. So she can afford the overheads, and, you know, she has the name value that people might say, yes, please sample this work, that's fine. We also have to think about artists, especially queer artists who are trying, if that's their ambition, trying to work their way up to that. Maybe they don't have the resources to create music in the same way, because now we've created a sort of class distinction between who can sample and what they can sample versus who can't, unless they're engaging with the catalog that's been explicitly made available for that purpose, right? That's a little outside the scope of the book, but I think that the in terms of like which artists are being sampled and credited and how, when we think about those ethical concerns, we have to think about sort of the identities and circumstances of the artists that are involved. And I think that this is particularly fraught for queer artists because of those reasons that I just outlined.
So as we wrap up our conversation, I can't help but think, however, that, you know, all books have a lead time where you're done with it, but it takes a long time to go through the process to get published. And in that lead time for your book, the national conversation, particularly around trans people, has changed significantly. And I think has gone from what I perceived anyway as more accepting of trans people, trans children, or, you know, giving gender affirming care and all of that, to states that are have tried and are succeeding in criminalizing medical care for trans people and have created an entire national conversation that demonizes trans folks. You know, if you don't want to get into this because it is outside the book, but I couldn't help but think about how different some of your scholarship might have looked had you finished it a year from now, as opposed to a year ago, you know, and how, you know, have you kept track of some of the trans artists that you have engaged with as they're dealing with a new national paradigm?
I mean, I think the conversation has shifted over a longer period of time to the point where I think the book still reflects what's happening currently. But I do think what maybe isn't reflected in the book is the absolute backlash that you sort of alluded to a second ago in terms of the introduction of, you know, increasingly draconian anti-LGBTQ laws, policies in schools, et cetera, et cetera. And I think it's very challenging because we like to think of history as moving in this linear progression. And as historians, we know that's not the most fruitful way to think about things. But I think that I hope that my book is sort of, excuse me, a snapshot of what's happening in this moment. But I also wanted to, you know, amidst all of this discourse, again, recenter the folks who are most intimately affected by these discourses, right? You know, I really wanted to recenter Black, queer, and trans musicians. And I hope that that's what this book succeeds in doing, and that it helps to keep actual people at the forefront of people's minds when they're talking about issues. It's easy to have this sort of abstract conversation about people's lives, but when you're actually thinking about the individuals, I think that can hopefully help help really illustrate what's at stake in these conversations and how we talk about queer and trans issues.
Well, I think this is a really fascinating book, and I do think you succeed in centering the voices of people that have long been pushed to the periphery of scholarship about hip-hop and sort of mainstream conversation about hip-hop as well. So it's a great project, and I'm wondering, what are you doing now?
So one of the things I didn't get to talk about in this book, but is still related, is the sort of specific experiences of Black queer women who are femme presenting in their gender presentation. And I also really didn't talk about bisexuality within hip hop specifically. And so I'm working on some new work where I talk about Cardi B and a little bit about Megan Thee Stallion and sort of this idea of bisexual erasure and how it's impacting our understanding of these particular hip hop artists and how that's particularly problematic when we think about femme queer women and we continue to default them to heterosexual, right? And how that impacts our understanding of their music specifically. I'm also working on a volume with Stephanie Jensen Moulton on American popular music and songs as narratives of domestic violence. And I'm thinking in my contribution to this volume is looking at how we talk about that and songs that address it in LGBTQ community specifically. So I think that I'm going to continue to think about queerness and hip hop and queerness in popular music more generally, and hopefully continue to build on some of the things that I offered in this book.
Well, those both sound like very exciting projects, and I'm looking forward to seeing them come out. So my name is Kristen Turner, and this is New Books in Music, a podcast of the New Books Network. And I've been talking to Lauren Kerr about queer voices in hip-hop cultures, communities, and contemporary performance. Thank you so much, Lauren, for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.